Welcome underground. My co-host has been reading a lot about panspermia this week, with a degree of manic intensity. Panspermia is the idea that life on Earth came from the stars, and that in fact the entire universe is teeming with bacteria and viruses. So today we're all going to learn about panspermia. Enjoy. So, panspermia, What is it?
Well, panspermia. You know, I have had such a good time reading about panspermia. I really, really like it. And before anybody sort of gets the giggles, it's nothing disreputable. It is from the Greek, pan, which means all or sort of total, and then spermia, which means seed. Obviously, no laughing.
Obviously,
at the back. No laughing at the back. And so it's this idea that the seeds of life are everywhere in the universe. That's the idea. And boiled down to its most simplistic and sort of digestible form, it's the idea that life didn't originate on Earth. It originated elsewhere and reached us through, well, interstellar space.
Well, that's a different thing, isn't it? There's one thing saying life is everywhere, and it's a slightly weaker claim saying that life came to us from came to this planet from space. It might just be one other place, and it came here from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously within the realms of the possible, within this kind of framework. I think that the sort of the more intellectually serious sort of proponents of this theory would argue that the strength of the theory is that it adheres to the Copernicus principle that this particular place, or really no particular place, is actually unique or special, and that you have to think in terms of what's true here is sort of true everywhere, which would lead you to expect that life is sort of universal throughout the or at least is common throughout the universe or galaxy.
I've been reading things recently saying that actually the universe isn't that uniform, that you have all these substructures and megastructures and filaments, things like that, but there might be bits of the universe that are extremely different to where we are now.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, we're talking about, you know, pretty big volumes here, aren't we? So you can sort of have a weak Copernicus principle that, you know,
space
within,
is big,
within the volume where sort of the rules we're familiar with apply, we shouldn't think that we're unique. And I'd say that's a pretty big volume, even allowing for your sort of megastructures and all that other stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. And I guess the other thing to bring up is the Fermi paradox, which is, well, if there's lots of life everywhere, why haven't we seen it?
Yeah. Well, the answer may be that actually we've seen quite a lot of it because it's everywhere. As we'll get onto, I'm sure in a bit, you know, one of the leading proponents of the theory over the last sort of 60 years basically thinks that there is bacteria and viral matter coming into the atmosphere from outer space all the time, to the extent of sort of millions of hits per square meter of the Earth. So that's quite a startling claim.
Well, I mean, when he says that, are we talking like entire life forms are hitting the planet all the time, or are we talking like certain protein chains or organic matter?
Organic matter and protein chains, that would be what the BBC calls pseudo panspermia, where and other slightly more sympathetic outlets call it soft panspermia. So there's two different. There's lots of different versions of this theory. And perhaps I can take you through a few of them.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So okay. So it's supposed to have been originated by this Greek philosopher called Anaxagoras, who basically, in fragments that have been sort of, you know, put together with a little bit of guesswork by scholars, claimed that seeds of life are present everywhere in the universe. Now, it's worth mentioning that, you know, for the Greeks, the universe was not what the universe is for us. They had no idea about the sort of solar system in the same way that we do, or the galaxy, let alone the universe. So when a Greek says, you know, the seeds of life are everywhere, he's really not talking about the same thing that we would be. But nevertheless, the sort of the word and the original concept is usually sort of dated all the way back to there.
To Bronze Age animists, to make sense that, the stuff of life is everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's a kind of a... But that's a less specific claim than the modern sort of panspermia claim. Kind of then gets going in its modern form really in the 19th century and early 20th century. There's this chap, a Swedish chemist called Svante Arrhenius, I don't know whether I've pronounced that correctly, who's often name-checked. And he basically proposed the idea that I've seen called radio panspermia. Basically says that organisms could be traveling through space via radiation pressure from stars.
So spores floating around, given power by the various forces that are...
Yeah, and you know, these spores must be configured in such a way that the sort of the ultraviolet and X-ray doesn't sort of completely degrade them. Which, you know, I suppose is not impossible, but many people would say is... Or many would claim is unlikely, but again, you know,
they are hard to kill. This comes up a lot in my mushroom cultivation, where like fungal spores are quite easy to kill in the pressure cooker, but bacterial spores, a special word for them, you can't actually kill them with the contents of my kitchen, and so you have to actually hydrate them and let them germinate. And then you can kill them after that.
From my sort of brief foray into this, I think that viruses and viroids, which are sort of, I think, fragments of viruses, are even harder to eliminate. It takes a hell of a lot of energy to degrade the sort of the genetic information that's within them, just because they're so small.
I guess for this theory to be plausible, we don't need a complex life form to land on Earth. We just need a cell that can multiply.
Or even
then that could be the origin of all life.
Or even just a sort of some form of replicating amino acid chains. I mean, that's all we really need, isn't it? I mean, but I'm already sort
proto-cell
of
protocell.
Some kind of viral form or something like that. So, you know, I'm going beyond my training here.
I thought the thing about viruses was they couldn't reproduce on their own.
Yes, you're right. That is the case. I suppose that proponents would start to say something along the lines of, well, it's a combination of viral matter and other stuff interacting that then gets it going and blah blah blah.
4 million years ago,
over geological time and blah blah blah. Yeah. Blah. But I mean, I don't think the technical details need to concern us.
Yeah, the technical
details
seem pretty. I had a look through the Abiogenesis Wikipedia page, and. Yeah, there's a lot going on. A lot needs to come together to create life, it turns out.
And
we sort of understand some of the steps, but not all of them, and we certainly haven't been able to replicate the process.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, life is a mystery. So this kind of, while this theory might sound wacky at first hearing, I don't think it is... I don't think it's not like aquatic ape hypothesis. It's not, you know, a lot of scientists will sort of get very sniffy about certain versions of this theory. I particularly enjoy the one that, you know, pandemics are caused by space viruses, which starts to sound a little bit more wacky. I emphasis on sound. But I don't think that the fundamental,
or octopus.
The fundamental idea that you know, stuff that's biological might be traveling through, you know, space or might be outside the atmosphere. I don't think that there's a scientific consensus against that. I think that, you know, there's some.
Well, I mean, we know the steps we take to sterilize the spaceships and stuff before they go to Mars. Like, we're aware that there's a lot of life stuff that can survive in space.
So you've got your radio panspermia. That's the idea that it's space radiation pressure pushing this stuff through the void. I've already mentioned there's the sort of the weak panspermia, the idea that it's the sort of the building blocks of life are coming on sort of meteorites and things like that. So that, you know, you're getting amino acid chains and sort of stuff like that, basically hitting the Earth through all the various ways things can hit the Earth. So they might be encased within, let's use the right phrase, otherwise I'm going to be really annoyed with myself. The name of things that travel through space and hit the Earth, it's a meteorite, isn't it? Is that right? So you have your meteors.
As opposed to what?
Well, meteors, comets, asteroids. So asteroids are things that... I don't think... So when something hits the Earth, it becomes a meteorite. Is that right?
So an asteroid impact is not technically a...
Well, I don't know.
I think we can worry too much about the precise terminology.
Fine. People know what I mean. Rocks hitting...
Rocks from space.
Rocks from space hitting the Earth. So that's that one. And that then links to this idea of lithopanspermia. So the idea that you might have microscopic life forms within rocks in space. So they're shielded from the radiation by the rocks in space. And then these rocks in space also, as they re-enter the atmosphere, the sort of the friction and the heat from re-entry that's sort of shielded by the rock. And then it hits the Earth and cracks open and hey, presto, there you go. So those are sort of the common ones. There's also, as I've been reading into this a little bit, there is just the idea that viruses and bacteria are just out there in the interstellar medium and that they're almost completely ubiquitous. The data that would... You might say that sounds completely insane, but...
Yeah, it does, yeah.
The dust clouds, for example, that we look at, there were these two scientists, and we'll be talking a little bit about these guys, I think, who, I think in the 70s, late 70s, maybe early 80s, first of all, Frederick Hoyle, writer of The Black Cloud. You might be familiar with him.
There's a novel, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where a cloud of dust... Oh, the Earth goes into an interstellar cloud of dust and it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it
and
turns
it's a whole
out
load of this... Oxford Dons sorted out, yeah.
Yeah, 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 in a bunker. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. And the cloud of dust turns out to be sentient. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So he and this guy called Chandra Wickramasinghe, and my apologies to him if I've pronounced that wrong, they basically predicted that these clouds would be about... composed of about 30% organic matter. Yeah. And it turned out they were right. There they are. So Hoyle is no longer with us, but Wickramasinghe is in his 80s and is, everything I've read about him, is an absolutely fantastic guy. I strongly recommend having a look at his website. He basically thinks that actually the people that say that, well, you know, that this organic matter, I suppose it's just about possible that this is the building blocks of life that have then entered the atmosphere, you know, through rocks hitting the Earth. He thinks they've got it the wrong way around. He thinks that this organic stuff in dust clouds is the deceased remains of life that is, you know, is everywhere. And that what you're seeing there in the dust clouds is the sort of the floating vaporized corpses of stuff that hasn't quite made it.
That's bleak. So it's almost like the stuff on the bottom of the ocean floor. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think I've interpreted him right. And I was listening to him on a podcast actually just before we came on and talking about this. And so I've tried to do him justice in what he's saying. Anyway, I found that very interesting. And you know, he really does believe that he's very clear that he thinks that panspermia is a much, much better theory than the default assumption, which is that life actually originated, has its genesis here. So that's a kind of a basic overview. Do you have any sort of immediate queries there, or do you want me to just ramble on?
We've missed directed panspermia.
Oh, yes, of course. What's directed panspermia?
Well, that is aliens. So it's a whole spectrum from aliens accidentally leaving, you know, life on this planet, you know, so some trash or some came off their spaceship or something like that, to them actively... seeding life on Earth deliberately in a kind of what was that film, Prometheus? That kind of way. Mm. Probably the weaker end of the spectrum of panspermia claims, but the one that's been explored a great deal in science fiction. Yeah,
the threshold for evidence of that one would be quite high. Occam's razor would say that you don't need the highly advanced aliens directing it and it might be better to start.
Yeah, if these other methods work, they seem more likely.
Yeah, we're an open-minded podcast here. We're an open-minded podcast. It could be. Could be. It just seems unlikely. Let's say there's no evidence as yet, I think. It's fair to say. So cool. So first of all, I think it's really important to say that Professor Wickramasinghe, who is, I think, the most prominent proponent of panspermia alive today.
Yeah, not just like, you know, fringe stuff. Like he's actually upended my entire like view of what the universe could be or what the galaxy could be.
Yeah, he's not some kind of, you know, strange man on the periphery of science, really. I mean, he is a respectable scientist, to put it mildly. He's got an MBE. He was at Jesus College, Cambridge. He's had many he's held many positions at many reputable institutions around the world. You know, he's not some kind of strange nutter on the
spot. Yeah, well, I mean, there is a rich and deep history of respectable academics hitting their 70s and starting to produce really weird and cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but he was doing it well before his 70s. You know, he was with Fred Hoyle back in the 70s. And when he would have been presumably in his 30s or 40s. 30s, I think, maybe early 30s. So he's been looking at this for a long time. And when you listen to him talk, he says that the evidence that there's loads of, you know, viral matter and bacterial matter in outer space. He argues that I don't think I'm misquoting him, but he thinks it's indisputable. He thinks the evidence is absolutely indisputable. And he cites, spectroscopy, so, you know, the analysis of the wavelengths of light. And he says that, you know, you do this for dust clouds, you do this for comets. He mentioned Halley's Comet and the tail. He said you do it for this. He says that he thinks that the evidence is almost indisputable.
But when he says organic matter, does it just mean stuff that has carbon in it?
So I am not 100% clear on the technical details, which will not surprise you. but my impression is that he is not arguing for weak panspermia here, where he's only talking about the building blocks. He's very much arguing that the biosignatures would imply microorganisms. So very, very micro. But that is my understanding of what he's saying, and apologies to him if I have misunderstood that. So that's really interesting. Really, really interesting. And I think that even if you're somebody listening to this and you're a scientist, you think this is a load of nonsense. I think that, yeah, it's worth having at least a think about it and engaging with the idea, definitely.
I mean, yeah, it's easier to believe panspermia, I think, than you know, life just emerging from, you know, a soup of molecules and lightning. But of course, it does kick the can down the road a bit.
Yeah.
Well, you're either saying, okay, yeah, life didn't get created here; it was created somewhere else. But it sounds like this chap is suggesting that life's everywhere. You know, it crops up all the time.
I think that is the implication of what he's saying, definitely. Mm. Now, I think that, you know, I actually think that this objection that, oh, you're just kicking the can down the road, I'm not really sure that that's a very good argument against panspermia. And I tell you why. Because whether panspermia are true or not is simply a matter of fact. You know, this is something that the data will presumably one day reveal. It is either true or it isn't. It doesn't seem to
and
me...
And then actually, that experimental moment feels quite close. It's like we've got lots of stuff in space, we're about to get a whole lot more stuff in space, and now Starship's up and running, so it doesn't seem like that much of a stretch to say, yeah, if there is lots of life floating around in our solar system, it will get stuck to our spacecraft, and we will start to notice
what we're trying to do.
So I feel that one could be validated quite.
I mean, this question is not some kind of thought experiment about the origins of life where we're just trying to come to the neatest and simplest answer. This is just an empirical question. You know, did it or didn't it? And if it kicks the can down the road, so be it. I mean, in a sense, I don't think this theory is trying to give a definitive answer to the origin of life. I think it is trying to, give a more plausible account of how something unbelievably complex and unlikely would be sort of in existence and in operation within reality in general. In a sense, it's adding more options into the mix when we're trying to explain how this happens.
Yeah, if we have actually massive clouds of organic matter that is just deceased life forms, that does change the narrative quite substantially.
yeah, I think that it's worth mentioning as well that people often cite these experiments where sort of craft, I think they're balloons, are sent up sort of to 41 kilometers up, which is a long way up. So we're really on the sort of the edge of the atmosphere,
yeah,
as we know it there. To take samples, and they found loads of bacteria up there. They found loads of stuff up there that's organic and alive and all of that kind of thing. I think the common explanation of this is that it's been blown up there in convection currents by sort of strong weather systems. But what an advocate for panspermia would say is that you've got it all the wrong way around. It's coming into the atmosphere from outside, There is a train of thought among panspermia advocates that there is bacteria and viruses coming into the atmosphere from outside all the time, almost saturating the surface.
And is the argument that these are kind of broadly the same kind of thing as we already have on Earth?
Well,
So they don't stand out as being very different.
Exactly. Because, of course...
They're not really alien because everything is the same.
Exactly. One of the really interesting... results of the panspermia or implications of the panspermia hypothesis, even the weak panspermia hypothesis, which is that it's just the building blocks that are arriving, that are sort of universal and arriving, that would imply that wherever there is life, the molecular fundamentals are the same.
Yeah,
which would mean that there is a compatibility is the wrong word, but you know what I mean. And the idea that there are viruses that are, viruses can enter cells and change the genetic makeup of those cells. I think that is a fairly well-known, established scientific fact now. And apologies to any scientists if I've got this wrong.
Oh, yeah, I will make no comment at this point.
I believe that is a well-known thing. You use a virus. I think it's viruses that are used to change, to modify DNA by scientists. I think that's basically how it works. I don't think that's a... I think we're familiar with that process. And advocates of panspermia would say that evolution, that one of the missing elements to evolution that we haven't got our heads around is that viruses are modifying the DNA of the genes of cells all the time. And that there are loads and loads and loads of viruses. And that some of these are coming from outside of the atmosphere.
Oh, so the source of the mutations that evolution relies on isn't just... kind of it just happens or bits of radiation or like a lot of it is actually space viruses.
That's the claim. That's the claim. It's just very interesting. I mean, it sounds quite out there.
I'm hesitant to comment too much after some listener feedback that clearly neither of us had A-level biology after our discussion on evolution.
anyway, so this I'm trying to give you a flavor of the sort of the claims that are being made here. Which I think are interesting, our own ignorance about biology to one side.
Yeah, I mean, but again, we come back to Fermi's paradox. Like, if there is, viruses and bacteria literally everywhere, why is there not intelligent life everywhere as well? Like, does that mean that the bottleneck isn't the creation of life? The bottleneck is bacteria turning, or, single-celled stuff turning into higher life forms.
I guess that is what it implies. I mean, I think that the desire to explore, I would say, the desire to truly explore beyond your environment and your ecology in a directed way.
Yeah.
What do I mean? I mean, going into environments that are more hostile than the one that you currently enjoy out of a sort of...
Yeah, not because you're forced to.
Not because you're forced to, because you sort of want to. I would be willing to bet that that is a characteristic hallmark of consciousness rather than anything else. I'm not saying it has to be a conscious entity that does that. I'm sure that there, you know, we're given enough time and complexity, a non-conscious entity could arise that does the same thing. But I bet you, if you were to run a million experiments, it would be mostly the things that were conscious that did that kind of thing. Because it seems to me that formulating that intention is quite an odd thing to do. And so adding in an element like consciousness and the sort of the psychological causation there seems to me to be a helpful explanatory thing of why that would happen. And so it seems to me that those two things would go together more often than not, right? So I reckon that the bottleneck would be not necessarily complexity, but consciousness. You know, the kind of mad desire to go into space, which when you think of it from a purely biological perspective is pretty mad.
Yeah.
Space
is tough. When you say consciousness, like consciousness is in human consciousness or consciousness is in like a dog?
I suppose what I mean is that's a really good point. I mean, I suppose what I mean is the complex consciousness with language and culture, whereby...
Yeah,
sort of
so it's not just the ability to take a short-term hit for a long-term benefit.
No, it's the kind of, you know, it's the
existence... It's narrative for yourself that drives you across the oceans.
But. Exactly. It's the existence of narrative and memes and culture, I think, actually. And I think I would put money on that being the bottleneck. Anyway, bit of a tangent. what I think is really interesting about what Wickramasinghe said is that, and I think for us this is what we should discuss because we don't really need much biological knowledge for this, is the idea that the reason why many scientists are so kind of sniffy about this and so dead set against it is it's nothing to do with the data. It is purely to do with the bias in their minds towards the idea that life must have originated on Earth. And he says, he has claimed that this is down to a sort of prejudice, an Earth-centric prejudice that is ultimately derived from religious traditions. Religious traditions like Genesis, you know, the Old Testament, that say that God created life and it happened on Earth. He says that this is, you know, the claim is that this is a very, very deep narrative at the sort of the heart of our psyche, the real heart of how we see the world and the universe and our place within it. And that all of these scientists who are part of the sort of the mainstream consensus that panspermia is very much unproven or a bit iffy, they are all actually prey to the sort of the power of this prejudice. And it is blinding them to the increasing amount of evidence that actually it would make more sense to think of something much larger scale when we're thinking about the origins of life.
I wonder, because I think it's something we've discarded before. Do you hear about polygenesis?
Well, I know what it means from the Greek, but no, tell me about it.
So in the Enlightenment, maybe before that, the Bible tells us that, you know, God created man in his image. But then you become aware of Africans or of Native Americans or the Chinese who look different to us. And it's like, well, if we're creating God's image, well, what are they? Because, you know, we're not both in God's image. People had a slightly more literal mind back then. Mm. And this was sort of a lot of confusion discussion. It was one of the live issues as people started to move around a bit more and explore. And on one extreme, it was like, well, they don't look like us, so they don't look like God, so they're not human, so we can enslave them or treat them very badly because they're not children of God. So that was one interpretation. Another one was polygenesis. Well, actually, Genesis happened a lot of times. Mm. Like the the Adam and Eve moment happened with our ancestry, but it happened separately in sub-Saharan Africa, it happened separately in the Americas, it happened separately in China. And that's why we look different. You know, the idea that we all descended from the same ancestor was not obvious.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but basically the idea was, yeah, Genesis happened several times in different bits of the earth.
So I suppose that we're
and now's a much more religious time.
Yeah. I guess that you could argue that we're approaching a similar moment with the solar system as the sort of European explorers in the sort of 1500s and 1600s were, where you're sort of, you know, your first forays have happened and the sort of the more detailed exploration is just getting underway. Would you say that's fair?
That's fair. I mean, my next question to you is going to be, okay, we're going to be on Mars soon. Mm. You know, Elon Musk reckons 2 years till his first rockets get there, and then maybe another 2 years or 4 years, and then we'll get some boots on the ground.
I mean, I don't want to, but in any way, knock his achievements, which are incredible. But yeah, yeah, I do remember him saying that in sort of 2018. It was going to be a couple of years.
Yeah, as he says, yeah, SpaceX is a machine that turns impossible into late.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
But given the trajectory, I have little doubt that we'll get some serious mass to Mars.
Yeah, I think within a
decade.
Barring unexpected incidents, I think I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so something unexpected would have to happen. Mm. Because it all seems like the technology is, you know, it feels tangible.
Yeah.
And yeah, given that, we'll be there soon, and it won't just be like a little buggy operated remotely. Like all the equipment you could need will be there. Mm. Will there be bacteria covering Mars or not? And through the theory you've been pushing, you reckon it'd be teeming with life?
Well, I'm not pushing this theory. I actually don't know whether I believe in this or not. I'm interested by it.
This would be quite a powerful proof point.
It would.
So if Mars is devoid of life, that is a powerful strike against the idea that.
Yes, like, it is. Yeah, because Mars has far less of an atmosphere, as I understand it. So you would expect bacteria to come. Although I suppose you could argue that if bacteria is sort of free floating everywhere, then having less of an atmosphere means it's harder to keep on the surface. But no, I take your point. You would expect to find the fossilized remains at the very least, sort of within the topsoil or within the crust, or I don't actually know whether Mars has topsoil, but you know.
Well, I mean, if it's coming all the time, like there should be some fresh bodies.
No, you're right. Yeah, absolutely right. I suppose the difficulty is that, and this is what is that you if it is exactly the same as the stuff that we find on Earth, the temptation is always to say, well, it's just contamination from Earth.
Yeah, it came on the spaceships. Yeah.
And I think this is what proponents of panspermia sometimes get frustrated by, because, you know, you find bacteria on the outside of the International Space Station or you know, in a sort of lander, and people say, oh, it's not very interesting, it's just contamination from Earth. And they say, well, no, actually, when you look at our theory, it makes perfect sense that it looks like bacteria from Earth, because our whole point is that bacteria from Earth comes from space, so you got it the wrong way around, and that's what they complain about.
Yeah. But again, if this stuff is just bombarding Mars all the time, like, it'll be just there in such quantity and over such a wide area that you can't say that was all stuck to my spaceship.
You could, but I mean, by the time that you've got the proper kit there, you've presumably been loading, you know, you've been putting serious mass down the gravity well for a fair amount of time. And, there might be some ambiguity, actually, about whether you've brought it with you or whether it's come from space. You'd have to send a mission to the other side of the planet with the kit, and you'd have to design the experiment quite carefully. But I suppose I'm being nitpicky. I think what you're saying is probably right. You probably can run the experiment once you're there and with a significant enough presence. You can devise an experiment that should answer.
I mean, planets are quite large.
Exactly.
Yeah. I take your point. Moves quite slowly. Yeah.
I'm merely trying to illustrate some of the potential epistemological issues that are. or not even epistemological, experimental issues, experimental technical problems that are faced in sort of actually doing this. Because if bacteria on Earth is from space, then it's going to be very hard to tell the difference between contamination. Especially because the viruses and bacteria, like, it's not like we've catalogued them all. We've cataloged maybe, like, as far as my understanding goes, a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the stuff that is on Earth. So
yeah, I mean, no one's really motivated to
yeah. So it's not like you've got.
It's not like collecting beetles. It's a lot less rewarding.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, oh, that's a slightly different type of bacteria. It's another one. So it's not like you can exclude the possibility that it's an Earth bacterium just because you haven't seen it before.
Yeah. Are we aiming too low with just bacterium, though? Like, I came across an amazing Mars-related panspermia theory the other day.
Go for it.
So the days on Mars are a bit longer than on Earth. Mm-hmm. It's more like 28 hours, I think.
Okay.
Just happens that if you take humans away from, you know, the solar cycle, we default to a 28-hour day. Like, that's how our biology works. Almost as if we evolved in an environment where days were 28 hours long.
That's a massive stretch. I think that there's the aquatic ape hypothesis, we evolved on a beach, and then there's the Mars ape hypothesis that we took.
I didn't make that connection. You made that connection. there are other bits of information that kind of add to this.
Right.
Apparently, there's something about the radioisotopes in Mars or something like that that are consistent with there having been a major nuclear exchange a few thousand years ago.
I mean, there's a...
Obviously, we know there was water on Mars once.
Yeah.
I think there are a few other bits and bobs. I probably should have researched it more recently, but this suggests that, humans evolved on Mars, flourishing civilization, nuked ourselves into oblivion, and survivors came to Earth, and this is us now.
You'll forgive me if I'm a little bit skeptical about that one. I mean... What kind of time? I mean, I know that you did. I mean, I know that.
I've got nothing.
I mean, what kind of time?
But then if we accept that there's bacteria everywhere, it does to me become less of a stretch for stories like that to happen.
Did we bring all the sort of the chimpanzees and bonobos and stuff with us? You know, our closest living relatives, according to evolution. Did we sort of bring all the fossil record with us to sort of, you know, confuse future biologists and historians, to be, you know,
not much of it if we did. I mean, there aren't many chimps.
Yeah, but
there aren't many
the stuff that there is. Did we bring it with us? You know, what about the sort of the fact that our cells are sort of full of salt water, and so are the oceans on Earth? Right,
they probably were on Mars as well before we nuked them.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I take the chimp pushback though.
Okay. Fine. The problem is that kind of thing. This is the problem with panspermia, isn't it? It's difficult to draw the line between the, for want of a better word, sort of respectable, defensible scientific hypothesis.
Yeah, and chariots of the gods.
The sort of the more sort of slightly out there, dare I say.
Yeah, but then it's hard to say. Well, I mean, yeah, if the panspermia thing is true, I mean, why isn't some of the other theories? I mean, if you're imagining a universe teeming with life.
Yeah. I go back to the idea that the question of panspermia is an empirical question that one day will be answered by the data. And it's not, you don't have to attach to it any sort of grand hypothesis about the origin of life or the universe or anything. It's actually quite obviously it's not a limited claim, it's a massive claim that life comes from outer space. But in a sense, it's
it's everywhere.
In a sense, it's a limited claim. You know, it's actually quite a simple question. Is it out there as well, or is it not? And we will find out. You know,
I mean, it's the same with my theory. It's like, well, did we come from Mars or did we not? I mean, again, I have no horse in this race, and we'll probably be able to verify it within a few decades.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I think that as two different sort of hypotheses go, I think that many listeners will agree with me that the one is slightly more likely and defensible than the other. But that's fine. That's fine. You know, sometimes you need crazy ideas. Maybe you'll be laughing when one day in sort of, you know, whatever journal these things are published in, sort of, you know, the Royal Academy of Mars or something like that. It says, turns out this is a return, not a colonization. And you'll be laughing at me. and I'll be eating my hat.
Just trying to work out which one comes up in classic sci-fi literature more often. Is it the cloud of organic dust, or is it life forms from Mars?
Oh, it's the sort of the twist that, you know, actually, you know, we're the Martians or whatever. That comes up all the time in sci-fi. Well, it does, doesn't it? It's like the whole Battlestar Galactica thing. It's been done many different ways, many different times.
Yeah, fair. Also, the Black Cat reminded me of one of the weirdest books I've ever read. It's called The Poison Belt by Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
Conan Doyle wrote a series based around a character called Professor Challenger, who's like Holmes's
Watson.
Shadow in some ways.
I see what you mean, yeah. His doppelganger.
He's a man of action, a professor, a sort of academic, but in the kind of Victorian way. So the first of his books is The Lost World, where he goes and finds dinosaurs in South America, which is pretty sick. The second book is The Earth Goes Through a cloud of cosmic gas and everyone dies. Okay. But he'd seen it coming. And so created a kind of scuba-like device to keep him and his friend alive. And then half the book is them wandering around a town where everyone's dead, and it's really unsettling.
Mm.
Then another book, I think it was a short story, he's on the sea floor. They find Atlantis, and then they accidentally awaken Baal. Hilarity ensues. And then the final one is... Professor Challenger says that spiritualism is bullshit and ghosts don't exist, and so some people show him that actually it does, and he's convinced.
Okay,
I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, I mean, there's some interesting stories, some interesting ideas. I suppose that this is the problem with panspermia, is that it's difficult to know where the sort of the defensible hypothesis begins and ends, and where the sort of the stuff that's slightly more out there. I mean, you need a deep expertise in things like microbiology, spectroscopy.
Well, that's the problem with all this astrobiology stuff, isn't it? You need to be both an amazing physicist and also an amazing biologist.
And possibly an amazing mathematician as well, because you need to... Yeah. There are sort of probabilities and stuff that are involved that are quite complex. And
well, whilst the academic world forces increased specialisation...
Yeah.
And so you can't think beyond the confines of your area. And that's why it's the old academics who come up with the fun ideas, because they're suddenly free of the grind and can start to have big thoughts in the way that the academics of old used to.
Yeah. But I think that what I keep going back to in my own mind is this observation that actually the it's very deeply rooted in our religious sort of cultural traditions that life began on Earth. And that does just make me slightly wonder whether there is a sort of a bias in our current sort of scientific thinking towards that position. And whether if we hadn't, you know, imagined a world in which we didn't have all of those cultural and religious traditions, would people be much more open-minded to this idea and actually be, maybe they would, you know, what's wrong with the assumption that it came from outer space rather than from on planet Earth, given that, you know, we have no idea how it originated on planet Earth. We've got no real notion of how that would have happened. And, you know, 3.5 billion years ago, when it is supposed to have happened, Earth was an extremely different and very, very hostile environment. So we're already comfortable with the idea that this happened in some very, very alien, hostile environments. It doesn't seem to me too much of a stretch to think that, you know, outer space, which is a very alien, hostile environment, is any more of a sort of conceptual challenge than Earth 3.5 billion years ago. That doesn't seem to me that
yeah, is. I just don't think the objection is religious in nature. I mean, surely it's, well, we're on Earth, we look around, there is life, and then everywhere else you've looked, there is no life. Like, Moon, not much life. Mars, not much life. Everywhere we've pointed our radio telescopes, not much life. And so it's like, the default assumption has to be that, you know, our life started here and you know, there's nowhere else close.
Well, I take your point, but what someone like Professor Wick Kramasinghe would say is that we have pointed our radio telescopes at places and we have found the signatures of life. Yeah, that's his claim. And this is where, you know, my expertise to judge that claim is non-existent. But that, you know, he seems to be a very credible scientist, and he says that he's dedicated a lot of his career to it. And he says, actually, you know, this is the signature. These are the signatures of life. These are biosignatures, and they're everywhere.
Yeah. So is it more that our prejudice is not so much against alien life as a concept as we're just not interested in life if it's not intelligent? We've only been looking for who cares? There's some moss on you know.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, well, anyway, I think that's an interesting one. So, anyway, your final thoughts there. What's your judgment? What's your judgment on panspermia? Pro, anti, nuanced?
No, I'm definitely pro. I mean, you know me and compelling and difficult to disprove theories. But what I'm interested in is the fact that, well, we should have some strong evidence quite soon, because I think we're about to enter a new space age.
Mm.
And the moon, certainly there's going to be a lot more happening there soon.
Yeah.
And then Mars, I think it's plausible. We have a crazy multi-billionaire laser focused on just getting stuff to Mars.
Yeah.
So I think certainly the broader and weaker version of panspermia will have answers soon, I think.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. I think it's an interesting question that is ultimately a relatively straightforward, and I mean straightforward here in sort of conceptual terms, a relatively straightforward empirical question where it's just a simpler case of gathering the evidence and designing experiments that are well-designed enough to answer the question. And you can go through the different versions of panspermia, and you can design experiments for each one. If you design them well enough, you will find whether the hypothesis stands, you know, whether the hypothesis is the data or not.
And Mars either is covered in bacteria or is not.
Yeah, or like there either are microorganisms in space rocks or there aren't. I think you're right. I think that it's not too far away that we should be able to actually have a look.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty exciting thought.
It is. People have mixed feelings about Elon Musk, but he's made the world exciting again. We went through about 10 years where it wasn't very exciting.
Mm.
And now that there's just this sense of possibilities, of discoveries, of explorations.
If it were to turn out that panspermia is completely wrong, would you be pleased or disappointed?
It'd just be like, as someone said... you think about aliens, is like if they exist, that's terrifying. And I'm talking like proper aliens.
Yeah.
But also if they don't exist, that's terrifying.
Yeah, I think that's Carl Sagan who said that. Sagan? Yeah. Sagan? I never know how to pronounce his name. You, we know.
I've always gone Sagan, but Sagan. Yeah.
I think that's a quotation from him.
Yeah. And I'm kind of... Well, I guess this kind of the idea of viral mass floating around is less terrifying than either extreme, isn't it? There is life, and it's not that threatening.
yeah, I know what you mean. So actually, you would be slightly disappointed.
It's the kind of beige answer. Yeah, I still want aliens.
Yeah, the ones you can shake hands with.
Yeah, exactly. The ones who communicate telepathically with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know whether I would be disappointed. I think that I would be initially or superficially disappointed because I'm a contrarian at heart, and I would love to see the experience.
It would be a lot of fun just seeing
everybody be like,
oh, everyone just messed up.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
But
and also I think we need some moments like that in academia where it's like, okay, we're completely wrong. We've just got to rip up everything we've done over the last 50 years.
Yeah, and we, you know, all of that kind of moral certitude that came along with thinking that we were right, that was all completely misplaced. And, you know, we really need to be much more humble in...
Yeah,
I agree. I think you're probably right that ultimately the more interesting result of that experiment is that there's nothing. There's nothing outside of the atmosphere, okay, in terms of life. Because that's a much more, that's a much harder question then to answer. You know, explain Earth. explain life on Earth. It becomes a harder question to answer, I think.
We're back to the question that the way everyone experiences it by default who doesn't know about panspermia. Like panspermia almost gives you a way out. It's like, okay, actually this is all a lot easier than we thought.
Yeah, it's kind of like a soft landing, isn't it, through the sort of Fermi paradox and all that.
So suddenly to believe in panspermia and then have it ripped away from you, I think that would be very brutal.
Yeah, I agree. But if panspermia was confirmed and in such a way that suggested that actually life is likely to have been seeded on multiple planets, with certain characteristics, that's exciting as well in the sense that it does provide genuine sort of empirical evidence that we should expect to find alien civilizations.
Some friends out there. Yeah. But also friends who are like us rather than life forms that are sort of terrifyingly, other.
Yeah, it wouldn't be like Blindsight. Or maybe it would be, but at least we'd share some basic components of biology. Yeah. So we'd be able to design a super weapon in the nick of time.
Yeah.
A pathogen.
That would play out.
Yeah. And Will Smith would be able to, like, fly an F-15 into the...
Yeah, and upload the virus ship and upload it. Windows 95 mainframe, yeah.
Yeah. Which is a comforting thought. Hopefully our listeners have enjoyed an amateur's wander through the theory of panspermia there.
I'm sure our lack of deep expertise was well hidden.
It allows us to focus on the important points. Shout out to Professor Wickramasinghe, whose work I very much enjoyed reading.
I do need to hit him up.
Yeah, I strongly recommend his website. He seems like a very interesting chap whose theories are definitely worth thinking about as a sort of a mental breath of fresh air when thinking about these topics.
If we do have one mission, it is promoting interesting chaps.
Yeah. Good. Well, I enjoyed that. Goodbye, everyone, for now.
Until next time.